Hello and welcome to another edition of Drug Fix, the Pink Sheet's Pharma Regulatory Podcast. I'm Derek Gingery, a senior writer at the Pink Sheet, and I'm joined by fellow senior writer Sarah Carlin-Smith and executive editor Nielsen Hobbs. Today is March 7th, 2024. Topping our discussion is another pending court case against the FDA from Vanda Pharmaceuticals. Vanda CEO Mihail Polymopoulos said in an interview with our colleague Brenda Sandberg that the company has decided to appeal the decision against approval of Hetlioz's jet lag disorder indication in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. The move apparently would be the first time it's happened in 30 or 40 years. FDA Deputy Commissioner Nemanja Bumpus announced earlier this week that there was no genuine or substantial issue of fact justifying a hearing on CDER's proposal to refuse adding the jet lag indication. The FDA denied the request and refused to approve a new indication, saying that Vanda did not offer substantial evidence of effectiveness in the disorder. The complete response letter said Vanda should conduct at least one more adequate and well-controlled study. Polymopoulos, I'm butchering that, I apologize, said the company would not conduct another study because it has exhausted the scientific questions and there is no question Hetlioz improves insomnia and jet lag. He said the FDA decision was because of internal policies rather than science or law. Polymopoulos also hinted that the FDA has concerns about Vanda's application for Hetlioz and insomnia. Vanda has heavily embraced using the courtroom for its medicines, filing 18 suits against the FDA recently, although most of those are trying to stave off generic competition or expand the Hetlioz indication. So, first of all, I guess I'm a little surprised that it took 30 to 40 years for somebody to go to the Court of Appeals and try and appeal an FDA approval decision. But I don't know, what about this whole case sticks out to you all?
That was definitely one of the things, and I guess the implications of how what happens in court here could potentially have ramifications if you know this company is successful or is successful in a way that motivates other companies to pursue this sort of strategy, I guess, legal strategy, what that could do to the FDA and its processes and stuff. The second thing that just, I guess, stuck out to me is sort of, I don't know, the indication they're sort of going for and I kind of being interested in it and them thinking about treating sort of jet lag as kind of a medical condition. But then I guess like what sort of the science is around that and then how, you know, FDA and the company were thinking about, you know, what you would need to show in a trial and the endpoints, because that seems to be sort of a bit of the crux of the disagreement here. But I just sort of have a lot of questions about, you know, how much the sort of the problem, maybe what the problem is, I guess, for people sort of impacts what FDA is expecting, I think, to some degree in a drug approval application, right? Like if we sort of, you know, all kind of know, you know, if you have a life threatening disease or condition or something with high morbidity and mortality, you know, the flexibilities and things FDA is going to offer is going to be quite different. And this seems like an indication that perhaps is, you know, kind of on the like very opposite end of the spectrum. And you're going to end up with really, you know, needing to then show a higher risk benefit, the benefit risk calculus is going to look different. And I'm wondering how much of that is partially what, you know, is really tripping this company up here in terms of what they need to show.
I was not even aware that jet lag could be so severe that it meets like the threshold of a disorder. I mean, most of us have had jet lag before. You know, you feel tired when you for a few days and then you kind of get used to it. Well, apparently it can get, you know, be severe, but which is, I'm assuming the population they're targeting, but yeah, I think we're kind of in the same boat. Like, are they chasing, you know, something here that, you know, we don't know if this is a real, you know, how big of a problem this is, or is there something else going on that, you know, maybe we're missing something in the science? I don't know. But yeah, this whole thing's kind of, you know, odd.
Yeah, it's interesting to, you know, look at the various successful challenges that FDA has faced of late. I guess it was maybe a decade or so ago that you know, there was sort of kind of free speech challenges to sort of kind of its, you know, oversight and regulation of promotion. And now, you know, we see mifepristone going before the Supreme Court this term. And that's essentially sort of kind of a challenge to, you know, sort of FDA's judgment on safety issues. That's sort of kind of how it's being framed. It's obviously sort of kind of a broader political framework to that. You know, if this Vanda, you know, sues is successful, and we'll now have someone challenging, you know, FDA's judgment of efficacy arguments. So, you know, kind of all these various elements of FDA authority that sort of kind of the agency relies on to do its job are now, you know, the case is sort of kind of promotions are kind of, you know, fairly defanged, and you know, we'll see sort of how the safety and efficacy arguments play out over the next few months and next few years, depending on how long this Vanda case goes on. But it could really kind of really sort of change how companies approach the agency when they disagree with its judgment.
Yeah, I guess I you know, I don't have a problem with, you know, having some kind of recourse if you think there was an egregious mistake or, you know, somebody's behaving badly at the FDA, then okay, you know, go to court, prove your case, and that's fine. But I guess it's another thing for me for a scientific judgment to be that was not made, it, you know, at least as far as we know, was not made with, you know, any kind of malicious intent or anything like that, or, you know, something wasn't known that now is known, or, you know, I guess I get concerned when my, you know, the scientists or a judge is who is not a scientist is going to try and decide what the, you know, the, whether the scientists made the right call. And I could, you know, I definitely can't make that decision. I don't feel like I could. You know, the question is, too, will they, can they, you know, how many judges can you go to before one of them says, yes, I can, I'm certainly capable of making that decision. I honestly don't know.
I was going to say that, you know, Derek, you just made me think about what, you know, has perhaps a more well-known legal battle going on right now that has a lot of FDA watchers, you know, on the edge of their seats, is what's going to happen with the Supreme Court case looking at mifepristone. And again, that sort of potential precedent that could be set there of courts sort of overruling scientific judgment of, you know, non-political agency experts, and what that can mean. And is this case trying to get to that, or does Vanda have like sort of an actual, I guess, sort of a procedural sort of challenge with FDA? Like, can they actually point to something and say, you know, FDA is not following their policies and procedures? They maybe treated us, you know, sort of differently than they would have treated another company in the same position. You know, is there an actual, or, you know, if they're trying to get a court to adjudicate like the science, right? I think that becomes a problematic precedent if the court is willing to do that, and for the agency and probably for science and society over the long term, right? Given, you know, I mean, right, we're all aware of the incredible amount of sort of expertise and various teams of people with different expertise, right, that you need to review a drug application, whether it's the biostatistics, the clinicians, the people with understanding of drug manufacturing, right? It is almost impossible for me to imagine a judge could possibly, you know, even, you know, a well-educated person who's could possibly, you know, take the place of, you know, that kind of system we have set up.
And I mean, my thinking would be if you're you would want to try and frame it as almost like an administrative problem. You know, like I think that's what they're trying to do with mifepristone, right? Is that they're trying to say the FDA didn't follow its own regulations in that, you know, in that instance. And so we need to roll it back because they did it wrong. I don't know if, you know, and again, we don't know the whole, everything that's been going on with this in this case, but I would think it would be a lot easier to frame it as kind of an administrative issue where, like, you know, we followed all the rules. We met all of the bar. We met the bar and you still said no, and that is some kind of violation of some regulation, go back FDA and do it again. Even then, if the court does say go back and re-review this, could they possibly reverse themselves? I mean, you know, I don't know how you would do it and not come to the same conclusion. You know, I don't know. Maybe that's just me. Maybe you make a different review team look at it or something. I don't know.
Right. I mean, in the mifepristone example, the judge just kind of, you know, declares what they think the label should be in essence. And, you know, you could sort of perhaps see that, if Vanda is successful here. The challenge for the agency is always, of course, sort of, you know, one person's scientific judgment, is another person's sort of kind of arbitrary and capricious. Arguments they make, as you're saying, Derek, we're going to be essentially sort of saying this, we're kind of, you know, we met the standards and the agency is not applying them correctly. And then, the judiciary will sort of kind of render a judgment as to sort of kind of what they think the standards are actually are.
Yeah, it's a really interesting case, especially with the current climate with, you know, not just mifepristone, but, you know, in general, just the climate around science and differing opinions of science and different conclusions and so forth. So I'm really curious to see what the kind of then happens with this one. And, you know, maybe we'll all be going to a DC Circuit Appeals Court oral argument here pretty soon. Next up is TV personality and former Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban, a fellow Indiana University graduate, by the way, and his battle against PBMs. Sarah, was he at the White House advocating for a different model?
Yeah, so I mean, I think people maybe who closely follow, you know, the sort of pharmaceutical space are perhaps not surprised that Mark Cuban has been a critic of late of, you know, some of the problems in our sort of health insurance system related to drug pricing and reimbursement. And, you know, that's why he kind of created Cost Plus Drugs, because he sort of realized that, you know, people were paying more in some cases for generic drugs with their health insurance than actually, you know, the pharmacists were making or their health plan was paying and so forth. But I think what was really interesting about this, sort of seeing him at this forum, and I've sort of noticed that over time, because I think when he initially kind of came on the scene, he got lumped in with a little bit of like the critics of high drug pricing or the critics of branded pharma. And I don't actually think that's really where he falls in many cases. He's really quite critical of the sort of middle actors and people who he feels like are unfairly sort of profiting off of things they did not sort of invent or produce and are taking, you know, just putting very high surcharge on. And I think it's quite beneficial to the industry in some ways because he's not associated directly with the brand industry. You know, he seems to kind of like have a fairly charismatic personality in some ways, I think. He's a good proponent. He's somebody that's going after the PBMs in a way that I think helps convey the message pharma wants received. Branded pharma about the PBMs without it coming from them, and sort of becomes a good sort of surrogate that's disconnected from them. And he was very clear at the, meeting how strongly he felt, and was, you know, kind of couched his remarks by saying, you know, I'm not going to be as delicate as some other people are going to be in making my comments. So I think it's to the industry's probably benefit over the long run.
It makes sense, you know, given his company is kind of doing the same thing. They're making, the generic industry has the same problem with the PBMs and the group purchase, you know, the whole middleman, or, you know, industry, whatever you want to call it. Because it crowds out competition and so forth. So it makes the business model tougher. But so I guess I'm curious, I mean, was this kind of just a marketing ploy for his own company, or, you know, is he actually looking to, you know, reform the system?
I mean, I think, somebody, and I mentioned this in my story, patient advocacy group, kind of very closely connected with industry. Someone from there kind of tweeted like about how, you know, Mark Cuban is showing that you can reform, you know, drug pricing or the drug or this sort of health policy system or whatever, you know, through capitalist means. And I think, right, Mark Cuban is probably right. I mean, quintessential example, right, of like a businessman and an investor, right? And so he is there, right, as a businessman who has businesses who he wants to get business to. But I think he actually, like, genuinely believes that there are problems in the system and the system can be reformed through, right, different elements of the business world. And that's why he created Cost Plus Drugs and has shown, right, that you can sort of make a a reasonable profit off of these drugs without, you know, extorting people. And in looking up some of it, he made some other comments related to a company or, you know, PBMs that were, you know, don't operate like sort of the big PBMs or the traditional PBMs. And I think he has some business relationships with some of those companies. At that day, he sort of announced that their company is also ready to start like commercial production of some generic drugs that are in shortage at a facility near Dallas. And right, they obviously plan to, again, I mean, he's not hiding the fact they plan to make money off of these products, but in a sort of what he would couch as kind of, I think, like a reasonably fair profit given everything, right? The idea is not that, okay, these pediatric chemotherapies are in shortage and we know, you know, parents and hospitals are desperate to get them. So we're going to charge, you know, 2,000% more than what, you know, the price was 2 months ago. Like the idea is that they see sort of like a bit of a market hole or a market failure and want to fill it, but in like, again, like what seems like, again, he would argue a reasonably fair pricing point. I'm sure you could find people would disagree with that. But I mean, I think, right, he's there for a little bit of both. I think he both on a policy sort of probably like philosophical politics level really does believe there's sort of a problem with some of these systems, and that at the same time he certainly does have businesses he's promoting and, you know, feels like they're operating in a better way. And just in the same way most of the other people who were at this panel besides the federal participants, I think, were people that have another sort of business interest in the supply chain. A lot of community pharmacists. There was a representative from the like California Blue Cross Blue Shield plan that has sort of, we've reported a bit on this, how they've reformulated how they're handling their drug benefits in part to try and have less reliance on some of the major, you know, PBMs in their practices. So everybody, right, nobody there is sort of completely there as like a all for the entire, I guess, like, what's the word, just for the sake of good to be good. But at the same time, all right, I think they would all argue that they all are genuinely trying to, within the kind of current system we operate on, help people with their healthcare needs and, you know, would say they just want to make a profit that allows them to keep being in business, I guess, would probably be their defense.
Not all altruism is putting everybody in the room.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. The Mark Cuban Cost Plus Drugs model is, as it says, for kind of cost plus, they sort of kind of charge a percentage, they say transparently is sort of a percentage on top of sort of kind of their manufacturing costs, and then they have sort of kind of a fixed dispensing fee too, and you can sort of see how that lead to sort of kind of clearer pricing, but also sort of kind of profit as well. And then sort of kind of it always depends on sort of kind of how you rank your actual expenses of sort of kind of when you sort of put the percentage on top of that as it's sort of kind of how much it actually cost. Was it the initial run of the production, or sort of kind of does it count the how much it costs to sort of get this facility for the anti-shortage mechanisms up and running and all that. So you can see so it's not perhaps sort of cut and dry as he likes to say it, and he's a good salesman and sort of kind of makes that make that case. And you know, as you're saying, you know, Sarah, the question is sort of how to move away from rebates is a tough one because you know, the sort of those smaller PBMs, you know, that were represented at the forum, you know, they don't have the leverage to get prices down from drug companies in the same way that you know, the big three, as they're called in PBM land, do. But you know, once you develop that that scale that they're going to get pharma companies to pay attention to you, how do you define how much of a discount you're getting without sort of kind of using this kind of you know, somewhat perverse rebate model? You could just sort of kind of you know, slash the percentage and sort of kind of push that all to the the plan that you're working with, or the employer that you're working with. But you know, then again, there's your kind of how do you define the you know, the percentage that you get to keep for that, in terms of sort of generating your own profit as someone providing this you know, pharmacy benefits management service. So I don't think there's you know, kind of an obvious you know, philosophical fix that people are missing. It's just a question of sort of kind of how they want the businesses to operate. And obviously, if the legislation that sort of seems to be in the offing sort of actually takes off, and sort of kind of there's this you know, kind of disconnect between sort of kind of the amount of the rebate that you're able to get and the you know, the fees you're able to collect, we might actually see you know, see lower lower list prices, but who knows sort of kind of how much actual prices will fall because of these issues of, you have to sort of kind of make money somehow if you're actually providing a service. So it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out.
So yeah, I was going to ask where we go from here. I guess there's legislation pending, but you know, is that going anywhere? I mean, it's an election year, so my guess is not this year.
Right. It's been a bit of a little bit of a surprise to people that they weren't able to get the PBM reform done as part of one of the two mini buses that, you know, are being, the one that was done this week and one that's expected in the next week to kind of finish government funding for the remainder of the fiscal year. And that does raise questions of whether they'll actually be able to get any of that legislation over the line, despite it being very bipartisan. So the outlook isn't great for PBM reform, which is hard to know how to make sense of that, again, given the political support. You know, I think there is a little bit of that like elephant in the room that came up just slightly at this White House forum, which is, you know, and Matt sort of alluded to this earlier, you know, PBMs were kind of created in part to help be the negotiator, to help keep drug prices in check to some degree. And so you might not want to just simply get rid of them, or, you know, you have to be really careful that, you know, whatever reforms you do don't create like consequences that are more problematic, or at least just as problematic. And I'm not sure that anybody has quite figured out how to thread that needle yet. And, you know, so it is a little bit striking to have seen that forum take place and then sort of the White House pivoting yesterday and probably later tonight with the State of the Union. They've already sort of teed up a lot of the drug pricing stuff they're going to pitch in the State of the Union. And, you know, that's very anti big pharma, as they call the industry, and very much for, you know, expanding government price negotiations and other things. So, I think, you know, the Biden administration, the FTC and so forth, I mean, I think they genuinely are concerned about the pharmacy benefits management industry, and particularly the vertical integration between other parts of the health system. But I'm not sure that they fully know how to tie that in with also their concerns with the drug industry themselves and the high prices of drugs yet. So we may be in this inter-industry war for another few years.
more interesting stuff for us to cover, though, right? So thanks, Sarah. Finally, we're going to look at the FDA's budget. The House on March 6 approved a full-year fiscal 24 funding package for the FDA and other agencies. As of the time of this recording, the Senate was still considering it. The current continuing resolution expires March 8th, but enactment of the full-year bill is expected. The bill would give the FDA its first drop in non-user fee revenue in at least a decade. The cut is minor, $8 million from what is a more than $3.5 billion budget authority allotment. But it comes as the agency is trying to absorb a substantial pay increase for its staff, as well as rising costs in other areas. Congress also mandated that the agency repurpose existing funds and put them to ALS, drug and device shortages, as well as information technology needs. And then another $8.5 must go to cosmetics regulation implementation and reducing animal testing through alternative methods. In past years, when the FDA would receive these kinds of budget authority increases, Congress would direct portions of the increase to specific priorities like this. So, yeah, the repurposing is a little bit of a surprise for everyone to see. Overall, the FDA still would see an increase in appropriations, though, thanks to $167 million in additional user fee revenue, which is bringing the FDA's overall appropriation, which is budget authority and user fee totals, up 2.4% to $6.72 billion. So some FDA observers are saying the new FDA budget is essentially flat, you know, given the kind of really tiny cut. But I'm curious if you all think this is going to wind up being a problem for the agency, you know, for the rest of this year and, you know, even going into FY 2025.
Oh, absolutely. They, it's especially difficult because sort of while Congress has, you know, sort of outlined the these priorities, as you were saying, you know, inspections, IT, ALS, you know, these other non-RX things you mentioned as well. The problem is they did not tell the agency where to find that money. You know, usually, you know, something like this would sort of come along with sort of kind of the you know, part of the increase would be sort of kind of earmarked for these things. But now it's sort of kind of essentially sort of kind of up to FDA to find where to cut. And because they don't have you know, a congressional directive as to sort of kind of what to do, what they should do less, it's obviously more difficult to sort of kind of to make those decisions. So not just from a you know, standpoint of not sort of kind of not, you know, having as much of an increase as one would expect, you know, given the automatic raises they have to give people in the government, et cetera. But they also sort of kind of face a philosophical conundrum in determining sort of kind of where to where to cut to make the boost that Congress is asking for.
So, in defense of those who supported the cut, and I was even unaware of this until I started looking at the figures. Congress has increased FDA's budget authority. That's the part that was cut 38% since FY 2024. That's a lot. And then if you include user fees, the budget for the agency has grown 55% in 10 years. But at the same time, the agency has been given more responsibilities and they're seeing increasingly complicated drug and device applications, which requires more expertise, and they got to keep up with things like AI and quantum computing, where they're competing for people to bring into the agency with private industry and academia and things like that. So there are people who will fall on both sides of this issue. You know, Matt, you were talking about cuts, ways to cut this. I make the cuts. It's probably gonna maybe some of it falls on the hiring that they have to do. You know, I mean, they either just do things slower, not bring people on as you know when they normally would, or you know, they just don't replace some people who leave, or you know, things like that. I mean, you could see cutting grant programs, but those are so tiny compared to places like the NIH. I don't know if you can make much of a dent in that. It's going to be difficult, I think.
Yeah, that's where kind of the headcount attrition, you know, obviously would be sort of an obvious area to kind of to allow those costs to flow down over time as you know, things naturally do. But the challenge is for kind of those you know, people may not depart into kind of the prioritized way that the agency is hoping. Not that sort of kind of they want to lose anybody. They're obviously going to value everybody's contribution. But you know, if they wanted to say, you know, focus more on you know, as we've written about, you know, sort of staffing up in gene therapy, or you know, getting more foreign inspections, or you know, those kinds of things, you know, they would have to make sure that whatever departures happened there were replaced. Either that means for kind of, you know, actually, you know, bringing someone new in, or transferring someone from a location that they deem as a lower priority. And because Congress hasn't told them, you know, what they think is a lower priority, it's going to be through kind of a, I think, you know, sort of a, you know, the internal politics of that will be challenging for the agency. That's what they end up having to do.
Because I was curious, like, with how much of the FDA's like taxpayer, you know, funding increases over the past years has were because of sort of like these emergency situations like COVID and others. And so I guess, has FDA really gotten as big a boost as we might? Has FDA, I guess my impression has not necessarily been over the past number of years that FDA has been as taken care of as it might have liked from Congress, given all of its like increased responsibilities and, you know, inflation and all of that other stuff. So like, even though this may seem like the first cut in a long time, it might not quite feel like, I'm not sure they feel like they are going from these like wonderful boom years to this, I guess, in some ways. Like, I think they probably still have some concerns that, you know, their sort of purchasing power has, you know, not maybe been as great over time. I mean, everybody's always, I guess, going to say they want more money, but, you know, I feel like, at least from the agency's perspective, they wouldn't necessarily feel like they came from such amazing funding years till now either, necessarily.
Well, yeah, and part of the, a big chunk of the increase that they've gotten over the last 10 years has been emergency funding, whether it's for COVID or for Ebola, and I think the third one was Zika. Those are the three public health emergencies that that were specifically mentioned in the bill. You know, so, but I mean, like, yeah, that's not recurring money, but it's still, you know, it's still paid for a lot of people. It paid for, you know, various things that I'm sure the agency needed and can continue to use, even though there's not, you know, the kind of urgency like we saw during the, you know, the peak of the COVID years. Yeah, you know, you could probably argue that the FDA hasn't been taken care of, but, you know, is any agency really taken care of at this point? So, you know, I don't think, you know, I mean, FDA will flat out admit that they can't hire, they've never been fully staffed to the positions that they're funded for. They can't fill them all. And some of that, I'm sure, is, you know, some of that's because of, you know, various problems they have with, you know, competing on salary and so forth. But, you know, I would think there might be some budgeting issues that go along with that. The other thing that comes up with this is that now the stakeholders and the advocates have an even bigger job ahead of them as the FY25 budget cycle starts with next week. I guess the President Biden's supposed to release his request. Supposedly the House has already started working on their FY25 budget, which will eventually filter down to the, you know, to the FDA. So there's a lot more pressure now, either to offset the decrease that they're getting, or push the number forward to be able to, whatever it is, offset whatever's happening you know, this year as well. Well, that's all for today. For more, check out our website at www.thepinksheet.com. You can also find this and other podcasts on the Sightline channel in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Spotify Podcasts, as well as smart speakers if they are your default podcast provider. Thanks again for listening to Drug Fix. I'm Derek Ingery with Sarah Carlin-Smith and Nielsen Hobbs. Take care, and we'll see you next time.